greatest tool ever devised for understanding how the world works.
Science is a vacuum for knowledge. We are always at the brink of the node.
Science is a collaborative enterprise spanning the generations. We remember those who prepared the way, seeing through them also.
If you're scientifically literate, the world looks very different to you, and that understanding empowers you.
Hello, this is Michael Dowd.
And Connie Barlow. And this is our Passing It Forward audio collage for the fifth and final session of Evolutionize Your Life. Now, in this audio, you're going to hear clips of four different conversations that Michael and I engaged in over the past year and a half, and they all deal with some of the major themes in Session 5, primarily evolutionary legacy, evolutionary activism, and the importance of honoring death.
In spring 2010, Craig Hamilton interviewed both Connie and me individually for a teleseminar series that he was hosting. A 20-minute segment of Connie's interview covers some of the major themes of Session 5, especially an evolutionary understanding of death and the importance of living our lives so as to leave a positive evolutionary legacy. If you'd like, you can access the full interview via our America's Evolutionary Evangelist podcast series and clicking on episode 25, Deep Time Eyes.
For the young, there's that sense of relationship, that sense of relationship, that's all you need. Then when we start learning about, okay, how does it happen? How did this complexification of life happen? If you find something wrong with the fact that there's death in the world, you know, a literal interpretation that some of the Protestant preachers make of the biblical creation story was that there was no death in the world until Adam sinned. I mean, T-Rex ate grass in those times. Everything was a vegetarian. There were no carnivores or, you know, there was no death until Adam sinned, disobeyed God, ate the apple, and boom, there comes the judgment. Now there's death in the world. That's the creation story. Well, if that's your story, there's something wrong with death. But if you, from the get-go, can start having an appreciation for the role that death plays, I mean, thinking about Michael, you know, Michael was on, for those of you who are listening, my husband, Michael Dowd, was, I think he was the second person you interviewed after Carter Phipps on here. And at that point, I can't even remember whether we knew that he was cancer-free, but we've just been through this major cancer debacle with Michael. And I tell you, that confrontation with death really clarifies for the person who might be dying and their spouse, really clarifies, what is my life about? What are my priorities? And boy, you get to it. Now, you know, if we're all living for 1,000 years, I might be a slacker and you might not be interviewing me at this point. So part of what I do when I'm with kids is I'm never afraid to talk about death. I always do it in the terms of stardust. Without the death of ancestor stars, there could be no planets and no life. They created all those elements, but if they kept them inside them, if they didn't explode and recycle them back to the cosmos, later generations of stars like our sun that just lit up 5 billion years ago would not have had the chemical elements to make planets. And if there aren't any planets, you can't make life. And so there's an appreciation for the creative role that death plays. And once you get that, an appreciation for death, then all of the rest falls through. There isn't the horror about the fact that, yeah, a lot of things do die. And even the death of species was crucial for the complexification of life. Not just us, but all those other beautiful, complex creatures, including the beautiful trees. These are all complex creatures that would not be here. It'd all still be slime if we didn't have species dying out. So I think that's crucial. You know, when you're teaching, learning the process concomitantly, there needs to be values teaching, exploration, the depths, going into whether we have a fear of death when we first learned about death, and gaining that appreciation, even though in the moment when a pet we love dies, a spouse dies, we grieve, but there's still an appreciation. We don't make the universe wrong for death happening.
So what I really hear you saying in the broadest sense is just that by studying this story in all of its details, it can help us start to come to a more authentic relationship to reality, start to understand maybe dynamics that previously would have frightened us.
And I have such faith in the human species, in the human species' ability to interpret. We're always making meaning. We're always telling stories. We can't not make meaning, you know. It's just something that we do. And I have faith in the human species that whatever evidence science turns up, we're going to be able to find ways authentically tell that in a way that empowers and delights. I mean, we could equally tell it in a way that distracts, that turns us aside, and that could be equally true. But the point is, why not? Why not take mainstream science, be completely devoted to the accuracy of it, and take it and look that square on and say, all right, how can I interpret this in a way where I can say yes to the universe?
So you're speaking here about interpretation, and so, which makes me want to push a little bit deeper philosophically. So as you've been indicating a couple points during this call, you know, in one sense, you and I represent two different ends of a spectrum of approaches to evolutionary spirituality. You have me and a number of others over on the kind of what you might call the mystical end of the spectrum, teaching about our potential to awaken to the interior of the evolutionary impulse as ourselves and to discover our spiritual liberation through aligning with that, surrendering to what we see as a kind of greater will, this evolutionary imperative, which I, of course, see as a divine kind of imperative, as in a sense one of the faces of God, and you and many others on a kind of other end of the spectrum. I know you regard yourself as a religious naturalist, a humanist, and so I'm curious to hear from you what you see as a spiritual perspective on evolution that doesn't include any sense of a transcendent divinity or even a kind of pre-existing conscious creative intelligent principle that is driving this whole thing from the get-go in some way. Because I think you probably wouldn't go there, right?
Right.
And yet you're talking about what you would call it evolutionary spirituality. So I just think it would be kind of rich maybe for us to dance around that one a little
bit. Oh, it sure would. Craig, I just got to pause for a second and just say, Craig, your questions are awesome. I love the way you push into it. So hear me go.
Thank you. Great.
I'm not willing to cede to your end of the spectrum the word mystics and mysticism.
Ah, okay. Cool.
when you look at Carl Sagan, Neil deGrasse Tyson, I mean, my gosh, I've had mystical experiences when I can start seeing with deep time eyes. I think the way I characterize it is you all go about your mysticism by striving first for that timeless, unitive state, whereas my end of the spectrum goes about mysticism by immersing ourselves in relational deep time ooze in which we just, it's like, wow, we go deeper and deeper into time and take that in. We're just swimming and relishing time and relationship, the diversity in relationships. So it's really a mysticism on that other end of the pole. I mean, you've got the unity and you've got the diversity. So we start off with that diversity stuff. But your point about the transcendent principle, this is where I think it's so important for those of us on my end of the spectrum to really try to teach what we mean by the word emergence.
Mm-hmm.
It's a feature of the process of not just biological evolution, but the whole evolutionary process that many of us are starting to call ourselves emergentists. We're not materialists. We're not so much naturalists. We're emergentists. And to us, the fact that the greater actually can come out of the lesser is divine. It's amazing. It's kind of like you and I having this conversation right now. There's something happening in this conversation that's emergent. There are new ideas I'm having, new ways of expressing. You and I, thoughts going on in our minds, and and amongst the people out there, there's something emerging in this process that's greater than me alone or you alone. When hydrogen and oxygen come together, hydrogen gas, oxygen gas come together, they come together and form water. And all the scientists of the world will say, no matter how much you know about what a hydrogen atom is and an oxygen atom is, nobody could predict the physical properties of flow that happen when the two come together. There's genuine emergence happening there. So when you look at the whole 13.7 billion year story of the universe, epic of evolution, the story of the changing story, when you look at it through deep time eyes, what you see is the glory of emergence. You see a universe starting from nothing, and out of that nothing comes energy. And out of that energy comes elementary particles. And then out of those particles come only the lightest atoms, hydrogen and helium, and virtually nothing else. And then out of the what Brian Swim calls the allurement of gravity, out of that allurement, not just this explosion of everything traveling out, creating space, and out it goes, and things get more and more dispersed through time, but you actually started having, thanks probably to dark matter, this aggregation into galaxies and stars. And when you aggregate enough and gravity squeezes that hydrogen and that helium together, boom, you get thermonuclear furnaces happening. The stars light up, and the hydrogen is being squeezed into helium. And E equals MC squared, energy is released. Now let there be light. This is emergence. This is genuine emergence. There was no carbon at the beginning. It emerged out of stars. And there was no, from my perspective, there was no self-reflective consciousness when bacteria started on Earth. Self-reflective consciousness emerged through time, starting with awareness, sensory awareness and perception. But it's genuine emergence happening. And so when I look at that process, even though I don't see a transcendent force, I see no engineer, I see, you know, there may be a primordial purpose that's inaccessible to science. You know, now we don't know what happened before the Big Bang, but that doesn't really interest me. I'm looking at 13.7 billion years of what we do know, and I'm going, my gosh, isn't that amazing? And one more thing, just as I'll be 58 soon, and so the early 1970s feminism made a big impact on me, and consciousness-raising groups and conversation. And so one of the things that I do have philosophical preferences, and one of my philosophical preferences is I so love believing, and this is a belief, it's not fact. This is my metaphysics. I love believing that the universe is pure emergence, because to me what it means is groups of us, like groups of us women, we could get together and converse, and there was no big daddy telling us what to do or feeding us the ideas. We were generating it in the moment. So for me, an emergentist perspective is a very 70s-style feminist perspective. I just love it.
That's great. Well, Connie, what you just took us through was really beautiful, and I'm finding myself feeling very inspired by it. And I'm wanting to still to kind of stay a little bit with this question because I find it so interesting, which is, what's your kind of deepest theology, in a sense, that emerges when you talk about emergentism?
What I have to say is what I just gave you and everybody out there is about as deep as I go philosophically. But I do want to point out where I think you and I both know that we need to be, and this is wherever other people are seeking, and that is we need to be able to look at cosmic history, whatever our sense is of it, in a way where we end up trusting the process.
Mm.
Trusting the process. Some people get a trust in the process by thinking that there was some divine intent. I don't think anybody on this call would have quite the sort of God's plan sort of thing, because it's evolutionary.
Right.
But nonetheless, you know, the sense, it's like that there's something good here, something you can depend on. I'm a flat-out emergentist, and when I look at the way the process has happened in the past, I just have enormous, enormous trust in the future. The way I like to simplify it, you know, again, I'll call on my husband Michael on this. But Brian Swim also mentioned too, and that is, if you can look to the past with gratitude and appreciation, that gives you a sense of the future that you can then trust, such that you're in the present moment, and whatever crises and troubles are coming your way, there's something deeper there that you're grounded in that gives you a determination and inspiration to move forward into the future. And for me, just let's, you know, look as individuals. One of the benefits of getting older is that you look back at the crises in your life and you remember that when they were going on, you thought there was no way out. You thought, okay, well, maybe this can get fixed in some way. But you had no idea that that horrible, horrible crisis in your life could actually end up triggering something, evolving something that would be better. I mean, you couldn't conceive it in the moment. So as you get older, when a new crisis comes along, you've got a history where you go, okay, Connie, all right, just remember those other terrible times. And you couldn't see a way out, but a way out happened. And trust that that can happen again. And so the way I like to think of it is, if we learn our 13.7 billion year history and all those crises in there, the mass extinctions, the impact, you know, the oxygen crisis, all that kind of stuff, that just deepens. It makes it possible for someone who's 18 years old to have enough of a history to trust the future in a way that a 58-year-old has a little bit more. It gives them a little edge up to be able to do that. But when you have this deep time perspective and you get an expanded sense of self, there's a trust that happens where you do not need to see the light at the end of the tunnel to get excited about participating. You don't need to engineer it. You don't need to see the plan of how this is going to work out here. But there's a trust that happens that if you're following your heart, following your bliss in participating and feeling yourself as the evolutionary impulse, you can just trust into it. And even when bad things happen, it's not like it's going to devastate you. Even if you're on your deathbed and you don't see right then and there that you have an evolutionary legacy based on all those years that you've done, you don't see anything, you can still trust that the ripples will be rippling out after you're dead. And maybe, you know, maybe you were an asset to this process. Maybe your time here on the planet has been helpful. And in that regard, I just really want to make sure I get in one thing based on listening to your other conversations. And Craig, you've always had a big question that you've asked. In fact, you made it your first one you asked Andrew Cohen. And I heard a lot of people asking you that in your telecourses. And that's that when you get an awakening, and so you feel the evolutionary impulse and you want to be part of it, and then you go home and here's your kids and your spouse, or here's your, you know, your work community, and suddenly here you are. What do you do? How can you be part of it? I really appreciated what Andrew said about it, because in my view, this is something parents know about teenagers. You don't just tell a teenager how to make a good choice. The most important choice you make is the environment you put yourself in. You're going to be talking to Elizabeth Satouris on Sunday, and one of the terms of hers I love is, she says, there's no such thing as rabbits in habitats. There's rabbitats. And that is that we are molded by our environments. I mean, that's what evolution is. It's creatures in environments interacting with other creatures, and evolution happens. So the major choices we make are the environments we put ourselves in. I know when I'm at a choice point, it's really important to me when a crisis is happening to put myself in an environment, and sometimes that means a three-day solo in the wilderness. Put myself in an environment that feeds me, that will draw forth the kind of choices that the depths of me want to make. And so I guess what I'm saying is that if you find ways to be in environments, it doesn't have to be your home environment, but connecting somehow to having an environment that feeds your choices, the choices will start to come, and you'll know they're there when it gets to the point where you aren't making the choices, but the choices are making you, where you know, they just come, and you know in the depth of your being that choice has been made deep within you. That choice has been made in your deep emotional brain, in your reptilian brain, that sense of survival and relation and so forth. It's not just this rational figuring out process. When the choices start to make you, then you know you're on your path.
Next up is a 10-minute clip from our podcast number 20, titled Evolutionary Legacy.
One of the reasons we're using the word evolutionary legacy is that we're living in a time where the stakes are really, really high, much beyond what the stakes have been in the past. Yes, your village might be threatened. Yes, your community might be threatened. Yes, your family might be threatened. But we're living in a time where not only our species, our planetary-wide species may be threatened, but we're threatening other species as well and the whole course of civilization. We're not living in a cyclical time anymore. We're living in a time where we know there's a deep time past and that things do change, and they change markedly.
And this historical consciousness is one that we all inherit, and now that we are aware of it, we get to be responsible for that. After all, when we ask about what's the meaning of an event or what's the meaning of some experience, what we're asking is, how does it fit in the larger picture? How does it fit in the larger context of reality? And of course, the largest context for our lives is the universe story, the history of everyone and everything. And we're all partaking of that. We're all participating in the history of life, the history of consciousness, the history of culture. And so how one's contribution to that helps further it in positive ways. And when I say positive ways, I mean in ways that increase empathy, in ways that increase compassion. I'm reading a Jeremy Rifkin's new book called The Empathic Civilization. It's an excellent book. I highly recommend it. But one of the things I've been preaching for years, and that we understand from this evolutionary perspective, is that in terms of human history, we keep finding ways of extending our circles of care, compassion, consideration, and commitment. In other words, we go from viewing our family or our clan as us, those who we love and care for, and everybody else is a threat. And then we began to cooperate at the scale of tribes, and then early nations, and then so on, until now we're faced with an opportunity and a challenge to cooperate and to have compassion and empathy for people very different from ourselves, and including compassion for the entire body of life of which we're a part. And so our evolutionary legacy, our evolutionary mission, what we pass on, the impact that we have long after we're gone, is in large part dependent upon what is our intention now. And I became really present to this in a new way, having undergone cancer treatment in the last 6 months, coming to be diagnosed with large B-cell lymphoma, undergoing chemotherapy, just having had an operation 2 weeks ago where my spleen was removed along with the tumor. I've been in the place in these last 5 months, 5 or 6 months, where I've been really present to the question, what if I only live for another 6 months? Or what if I only live for another year? What's my legacy? In other words, what's the most important thing that I could communicate in the next 6 months or year on the chance that I might not be here in 2 years or 3 years? And so it's sharpened my focus with regards to the importance of my own legacy, but it's also helped bring into focus for me the whole question of what is it that gives our lives meaning, and how can each of us find those places where our joy and the world's needs intersect, such that our work in the world, our contribution to the world, whether it's for pay or volunteer, is in some way furthering evolutionary history. In other words, it's furthering love and compassion and generosity and care and consideration and ecological right relationship with the planet and with each other. And I just think that's, Connie and I both think that's just a vitally important topic. And this is really the crux of what it means to further evolution in healthy ways, is to get so in touch with your values, with what's most important to you, with what's really true for you about the way life could be, should be, what it would mean for all people to be respected, what it would mean for each of us to be able to follow that divine impulse, that creative impulse within us to make a difference, to make a contribution, to in some way be a blessing to the world. And where we come up against injustice, where we come up against violent conflict, where we come up against ecological, evolutionary devastation, wherever it is that we, where we know in our guts and in our hearts that something's not right, that that's not the way things should be, or at least that's not the way things can, that's not the way that things can continue to be for us to have a healthy future. To be in touch with those things such that whatever forms of activism, whatever forms of making a difference or getting out to the world or in some way contributing to a healthy future, whatever ways those occur to us or those whatever ways present themselves, that we do so from a place of conviction, being in touch with what it is that we're living for, what legacy are we leaving, and what's so important to us that if push came to shove, we'd be willing to die for. In other words, it's that important. Where would we be willing to put our lives on the line?
Since evolutionary spirituality is becoming kind of the hip thing to talk about and do and think about, a number of us are really trying to push this in a direction such that a shift is made at some point to recognize that evolutionary spirituality, to use that term, demands that one participate in the evolutionary process. The spiritual path is not just your personal connection with the cosmos or a sense of greater being or whatever, you know, you have a sense of whatever might happen after your death to your soul or spirit or whatever, perfecting it. You can have that if you want. But to use the term evolutionary spirituality, there has to be a sense of presence and engaged participation with the world around us, such that we're using the deep time understanding of where we've been and what the conditions have been and the processes in the past, and we're using a deep time perspective of where things are going in the future, such that our actions in the world are really intentional and are really courageous in one way or another.
Evolutionary spirituality in this regard is really relational spirituality. It's about being in right relationship. And it's a practical spirituality. It's not just an inner process, but it's what are the practices, what are the exercises, what are the tools that allow me to be, that help me to be in right relationship with all the people in my life, and with my bioregion and with the planet and with other species. It's not an otherworldly thing. It's not a personal thing, although it obviously has, you know, personal aspects, but it's really about what does it take? What will lead me to be in right relationship? What will lead me to grow in humility, authenticity, responsibility, service, such that I can leave a positive legacy deeply?
And it doesn't mean having all the answers or having it figured out exactly. We need to do this and then we need to do this and here's what I'm going to do in order to have things come out this way. A lot of it has to do with getting a deep sense in your core of what's right action for you. Where can you find your joy while you're participating, even if it has some dangerous elements to it? It's not something you have to force yourself to get up in the morning and do. It's keying in on what some people call the evolutionary impulse and seeing what that's leading to you to do. And then having faith and working collaboratively with others that the ripples from your actions will work out spatially and in time, such that a positive legacy will be left. You will have a positive imprint on this planet. The interesting paradox about this approach as well is that one can think, well, I don't have enough education, or I've got too many troubles in my life, or I'm too depressed, or, you know, I can't be effective. Until I get my own act together, I'd better work on myself some more. I'd better do some more meditation, or I'd better take some more spiritual education because I need to fix myself first. One of the things that's so profound about these evolutionary times is that if one simply trusts and steps out there in some small steps, in acts of service, to actually get in action in the world in some way collaboratively, then that in turn will feed back on one's own depression, on one's own sense of inadequacy, and finding that service in itself becomes a spiritual practice that enhances oneself.
Yeah, another way of talking about that is that when we are a blessing to someone else, we inevitably find ourselves blessed. We inevitably benefit from that interaction. It's very rare indeed, if at all, where we truly serve someone, love someone, bless someone, in some way make someone feel good, that we don't feel good in the same process. And, you know, there's tons of research. There's a lot of evidence over the last 15, 20 years, and probably going back a lot longer than that, but there's been a lot of it recently, that shows that happiness comes not from pursuing happiness, but from pursuing a life of, or at least at times, service, being a blessing to someone else, in some way being a contribution to the health, the well-being, and the happiness of another, whether it's a child or your next-door neighbor or whatever it may be.
Following is a 13-minute clip from Michael's and my America's Evolutionary Evangelists podcast series. It's podcast number 16, titled Evolutionary Activism.
Today we're going to talk about Tom Attlee's new book called Reflections on Evolutionary Activism.
The subtitle is Essays, Poems, and Prayers from an Emerging Field of Sacred Social Change. Just published December 2009 and available through Amazon.com. So we're going to start off with a chapter that's called What Makes Evolutionary Activism Different from Other Forms of Activism? It's on page 63. He's got seven items there, seven subtopics that he covers in this short chapter. And we're going to read to you what he has as his seventh and final point.
So the seventh point is evolutionary activism sees itself as part of the great story of evolution becoming conscious of itself and invites others into that story. The factual story of evolution provides a profoundly meaningful context for whatever actions we do on Earth today. This is even more true for evolutionary activists and leaders seeking to participate in evolution consciously, or to be evolution. As part of that story, their work has a mythic, heroic quality, although manifesting in a more humble, catalytic, co-creative way than we normally associate with heroes and leaders. Evolutionary activists and leaders know that their power is not theirs, but is the creative power of evolution itself, as old as the universe, as wise as nature. They are but stewards and channels for that immense and ancient power, opening themselves to the unfolding story in, through, and around them. This story is so meaningful, liberating, and empowering to them that they seek to share it with others.
So the point that Tom makes here, evolutionary activists and leaders know that their power is not theirs, but is the creative power of evolution itself, as old as the universe, as wise as nature. Now, one of the things I love about him including that, for several reasons, that in a book called Evolutionary Activism, is that for many people, it's been the discovery, the deep-felt discovery, usually coming through conveyance from somebody else, that the universe is not just out there, but it's also within us. We are an expression of the universe. And more than that, to the extent that you can set yourself in a broader context and feel that whatever the issue is you're working on, it's not just about you, it's not just about your group of activists, it's not about just about your particular issue in your particular home region or your home planet. It's about something even bigger than that, something that no one can fully grasp and describe, but is can go a heck of a long way towards counteracting activist burnout if you consciously put yourself into that greater force.
Yeah, another way of thinking about it, Joanna Macy and others speak about it this way too, is the greening of the self or the universalizing of the sense of self. In other words, our self doesn't just stop with our skin. Our self includes the larger body of life of which we're a part, and ultimately our largest self is the universe itself. In other words, the universe has been expanding, And it started out in just hot, dense energy. And then the first atoms that formed were hydrogen and helium, the simplest atoms. And then in stars, more complex atoms. And then on planets nearby stars, such as planet Earth, more complex, molecules. And then life, simplest forms of bacteria, and then more complex forms of life, and then more complex forms of life. And then humans emerging out of primates, mammals and primates, humans, hominids first emerging, and then humans with language that can collectively learn. We can share and store information through language, through stories and that sort of thing, and then later on when writing developed. That sense of identification, that my largest self includes the universe, my larger self includes the body of life, gives activists a sense of grounding and also a sense of inspiration and also a sense of doing the good work, doing that which is working for a healthy future for all of us, but doing so from a place of trust, of gratitude, of empowerment that often many activists don't get if they don't have that larger perspective.
The other thing it does is that while there will always be a place for design and engineering and planning and strategizing and having a goal and figuring out the steps to get there, while there will always be that aspect to it, placing yourself within this larger context of the way evolution works and works in all the larger realms, within and around you, offers up a possibility for checking deep within oneself and one's comrades for where's the impulse, where am I being allured into action, and whether or not you can see how it's going to play out, how you can test along the way whether it's working or not. Even when you sense setbacks happening, you can go into a realm of trust that looks for opportunities despite the fact that it looks like you're not getting anywhere, and recognize as well that you're not working with intelligent design here. You're working with evolutionary emergence in which no single mind, no groups of minds can anticipate what's going to come out, what's going to unfold, and our path for getting there. And of course, it means that in order for things to happen, there have to be a lot of people testing out a lot of different ways of doing things, not all of which are going to work. We've got to have that openness to diversity of options and allurements, because you can't sort them out in the beginning and just say, nope, that's not going to work. Nope, that's not going to work. It's a real radical openness to possibilities.
And one of the ways that big history, which is the history of everyone and everything, or the story of the universe, one of the ways that this inspires many of us who are activists and many people who have given their lives to, a healthy future for all of us, is not just this sense of identification with the larger realities of which we're a part, kind of like nesting dolls. It's like we're one of the mid-sized nesting dolls within a larger nesting doll, but we're also made up of smaller creative wholes. Not just that sense of identification, but also the knowledge, not the belief, but the knowledge that we now have, thanks to our evolutionary understanding, that chaos, breakdowns, and what we could call bad news are a primary catalyst of creativity throughout billions of years of evolution. And that allows us to trust the setbacks, to trust the chaos, to trust the breakdowns, to trust the things that we try to do and it doesn't work, because we keep coming back as evolutionary activists to the question, okay, this is real, what's possible now? And that sense of what's possible now, when it's grounded in an evolutionary understanding, is very powerful.
We know that all the activists, particularly the spiritual activists, the Gandhi types, the Martin Luther King types, there's been an emphasis on integrity of process, the integrity of the way you go about your activism, and that you don't focus for satisfaction on whether you're actually accomplishing what needs to be accomplished. But the satisfaction comes in doing what you feel compelled to do that feels important.
And it's an integrity with this larger process that we're a part of.
That's in integrity with it. And so having this sense that there's something bigger out here working means that I think activists, particularly when you're kind of young and you just got to see those results right away. I remember when I was a wilderness activist in the 1970s, in Southeast Alaska. You know, I was young and with a bunch of other wilderness people working on what eventually in Jimmy Carter's era culminated in the Alaska Lands Act. And, you know, I had a role, National Interest Lands Act, and I had a role to play in that. But along the way, there are always kinds of setbacks. And I remember it was so useful to have in our presence Celia Hunter, whom I adopted as my sort of adopted Alaskan mother, since my mother was back in Michigan, a long, long distance away. And Celia just had this equanimity about her. She had been fighting for Alaska ever since just after World War II when she moved there. And when the rest of us would wring our hands and feel like throwing in the towel when we lost a particular fight, she would just have the presence as an elder to take us back into the realm of, you know, of doing what we need to do with integrity and not focusing so much on whether we have victory, but whether we are working well together and following our heart, following where we seem to be led to go and doing it with integrity.
Following those places where your great joy and the world's great needs intersect. Because in those intersections where what turns you on, lights you up, fills you with joy and passion and energy, things you're good at, the things other people tell you you're good at, etc., and where the world's needs are, not just as you know about the world's needs intellectually, but where your community's needs and where the world's needs are that touch you, that hit you, that make you feel emotion. If you list in two columns each of those things, all the things that light you up, turn you on, give you joy, and then all the places where you feel the world's needs, and simply follow the leading of your own heart and try to find intersections. You're trying to play mix and match. Where are the intersections between what your joy is and the world's needs are? And that's your calling. And that's what I think Tom's entire book in some ways is about, helping people to follow that place where their joy and the world's needs intersect in a way that nourishes them and nourishes the larger body of life.
So Michael and I are going to end with reading back and forth, almost a litany kind of thing that appears on page 188 in Tom Attlee's book, Reflections on Evolutionary Activism. It's a section called Being Part of the Big Story. And of course, this is what Michael, this is what we're up to.
In these times of daunting emerging crises, some truths that most potently shape my life are these. The Big Bang is our awesome primal ancestor. We are its children, its legacy. Its energy is ours, whether we know it or not.
We are the hydrogen dew of the universal beginning that was then forged in red giant stars and exploding supernovae to become every atom of our bodies and our world.
For billions of years, we've been flowing with every other particle in the universal river of stardust on an exquisite, unlikely, painful, magical, and infinitely creative journey into the lives and worlds that we live in and are today.
Over and over, I forget this awesome truth in my seemingly ordinary everyday life. Then over and over, I remember it. Truly, a miracle is unfolding within and around me, moment to moment, hidden by the camouflage of business as usual.
But for better or worse, you and I are on the verge of business as usual, tearing itself apart before our very eyes, revealing the raw truth of evolution here and now in our time, in our place, in our hearts and minds. Evolution always speeds up in the verges, the edges, the crises, the between world spaces where anything can happen.
And we, on that edge, are speeding toward a whole new identity, a whole new story of who we are and what we are about.
Today, we are the 13.7 billion-year evolutionary adventure, dreaming of becoming conscious of itself, of becoming knowingly choiceful, able to evolve by aware understanding, will, and caring. If we awaken, evolution will awaken, and we'll step consciously away from the cliff into a dramatically different, vibrant, co-creative world.
Finally, we offer a 23-minute excerpt from an interview that Michael and I did with one of our closest colleagues in this epic of evolution movement, John Cleland Host. As you'll see, John's background as a chemical engineer not only earns him a living, but it provides him with a special form of depth access to certain aspects of the natural world.
This interview is part of Michael's and my Inspiring Naturalism podcast series. It's podcast number 4B, titled John Cleland Host. It's all really there.
When you think about big history, when you think about the epic of evolution, our science-based common creation story, where do you find these core emotional benefits, these core feeling states that humans have always needed to thrive? Feeling states like trust when you look to the future, including a future without you, gratitude when you look to the past, rather than guilt or judgment, resentment, and also inspiration in the moment to be in action, whatever the challenges are. So you can take those one at a time or whatever, but I'd love to hear where some of these core feeling states, such as trust, gratitude, and inspiration, where you derive those from a naturalistic evolutionary perspective.
Well, one of the most powerful benefits of an evolutionary worldview is the huge, huge wave of gratitude. Just about anything that isn't really, really bad is worth being grateful for, and all of it ties back to our history. We could talk about things that we experience, like chocolate or strawberries, or the two of those together, or sex, or I enjoy rock climbing, or all these other things that are wonderful, wonderful legacies. Everything we love about them are legacies of our evolutionary heritage.
Wait. An example so that people get that. The rock climbing one is obvious. And that is, if our ancestors had never lived in trees, we would not have the capacity to grab onto branches or rocks or so forth. And so I'll often have kids move their fingers and say, we can do this. We can build instruments. We can, you know, hold pencils because our ancestors lived in the trees. Cool.
The thing that I'm especially for with regard to something like rock climbing is, yes, the ability is wonderful. And yes, it's something to be grateful for. But even more than that is the fact that we enjoy it. If we didn't get an evolutionary advantage from doing it in the past, of our ancestors doing it, we wouldn't have the wiring that makes us enjoy it. And if we didn't get that charge of enjoying it, then I certainly wouldn't be out there rock climbing today and getting to the top of the cliff and turning around and going, oh, this is awesome. Oh, this is great. It's great and wonderful because it benefited our ancestors. So many things where it's our history that makes things pleasurable and wonderful, and we enjoy things day to day on a regular basis. And it's so easy to just let that go and not even notice it, but to just grab each one and say, oh, this is great. And so many of my ancestors suffered and struggled and worked, with the net result being that I get to experience this wonderful thing right now, and we get that, you know, many, many, many times every day. And to just tap into 1% of them makes you a much happier person throughout your whole life and much more effective and a blessing to everyone around you, including yourself. The one thing that I do, one of my spiritual practices, is every morning I sit and I face the if you look at the wheel, the direction of the season. For this morning, for instance, it was east that way. And I'll sit and I'll spend a little time connecting to the universe and thinking about the universe. And I might meditate, I might think about or dwell on any number of things, whatever's relevant and important at the moment. But one of the things that I always do is on Tuesdays, specifically on Tuesdays, I make it a point to think and be grateful for a number of things in certain categories. If you put important human attributes on the wheel, and other people have done this, and the way that I do it is I put mental things to the north, spiritual things to the east, physical things to the south, and community or social things to the west. And I'll go through that wheel and I'll think to myself, what can I be grateful for that happened in the last week that I saw in the last week having to do with mental things to be grateful for? And I might think, oh yeah, I made that big Excel sheet with all those calculations. There's no way I could have done that if my primate ancestors hadn't had to figure things out and figure out how to get something that works. And then I'll think, okay, to the east, what about my spirituality gave me special inspiration sometime in the last week? I might think about feeling the excitement of coming over a hill and looking out over a vista and thinking, oh yeah, my primate and Neolithic ancestors got such a big payoff. If they could come over a hill and see maybe resources to benefit the tribe or the clan and be able to get joy from that. And I got joy from that just the other day. And all I got was just pure joy from it. I didn't, you know, benefit my tribe or clan at all, but I still got that charge. And I'll go through, and then physical, that one's always easy. I think, what am I really grateful for? Well, I'm grateful for that I'm not really sick and in pain in bed this week, and I could be because that happens. Or I'm grateful that I was able to, you know, run or move this firewood or whatever. And then I'll go to the West and I'll think about what am I specifically grateful for that happened in the last week about social networks or friends or family members or something like that. And I'll do this every week. I call it Gratitude Tuesdays, to sit in my little time in the morning and just on Tuesdays to use that just specifically for gratitude. Other days too, but always on Tuesdays.
For the gratitude, I love your Gratitude Tuesdays. It's a beautiful phrase there, but so many times Michael and I will have just a regular meal, a regular dinner, and yet we'll reflect on that we are eating better than kings, that we're alive when our ancestors were poor. We right here are eating better than kings. And even just back to my mom's generation, if she was really lucky in her Christmas stocking, she might get an orange. To get an orange in December? Unbelievable.
And it's not just food. We lived better than kings just a few generations ago in I don't know how many different aspects of our life. Dentistry, blah, right? Or I think of the fact that without science developing certain medical technologies, just some very specific ones, I would have been dead 15 years ago when I had the brain tumor, because they used a two-year-old technology, a technology that had been developed just 2 years before to get that out.
So, John, again, coming back again to this question of inspiration, what have you found that inspires you most in this great story, Epic of Evolution perspective? And how has this perspective enriched or shifted earlier ways of thinking?
Well, the first shift that I noticed actually happened before I was fully to a naturalistic point of view. It happened from just learning about things. I grew up in a family where we really wanted to learn about things. And I went to college and went into the physical sciences. And I learned about the infinity when you go down in scale. When you look at things at a smaller and smaller level, at a molecular and cellular level, if you're talking about biology. But what I learned was things from a physical science. I learned that things like pieces of metal have a crystal structure where the atoms are arranged in a certain way. And this goes on for millions and millions of atoms, always in a regular pattern until you get to a grain boundary. And then it shifts to the same pattern in a different orientation. And to be able to look at metals like that stovepipe over there, or the lamp over there, or this can, and see deep down inside that kind of structure stretching out in all directions, or to see in ceramic materials like a rock. Look at a rock. A rock is a rock, right? No, it's a rock, but I look at it and I see the crystal structure with different molecules in different places that bonded a lot of times more covalently or ionically and not necessarily metallically. And I see this when I look around the room. I see all these different things so much more deeply than if I didn't know about this. And then learning more about the great story and really integrating it into this view, what it does is it puts the past behind everything. I see things forming for the rock. I might see it being metamorphosized under the earth and then melted through igneous processes and formed through a volcano. For sedimentary rocks, you've got all the biological stuff and the sedimentation. And I see a landscape where I look out and I see, like in Michigan, I see this lake. I see it first as a lake, but then it dwindles down to a river because it was dammed up and formed this lake. And I go farther back and I imagine the land shifting and changing, the trees being cut down until we've got a desolate desert from the logging, stumps as far as you can see. And then I look farther back and I see the glaciers come across and bury us under miles of ice. And I see farther back where the glaciers are back up, and then we have the Bearpaw Seaway, and I think it's just
wonderful. It's all.
I look at this. I look at the video in A Symphony of Science where Richard Feynman says, it's all really there. And the potential in the future is there too. You can go forward and all this stuff will happen and we don't know what it is. We can help create it. I see all those infinities stacked up and I think to myself, this rock and this tree and this river, all of these things have this multitude of stuff. It's like they have their own spirit. It's like they have their own life. And I think to myself, that is a real world realization of my Native American ancestors' belief that every rock and tree has a spirit of its own behind it. I think it's all really there. But that's how the Native Americans really did see this spirit and this feeling behind everything. And now when we see these infinities of size, scale, and time, we can get that back too in a very powerful way.
Yeah, you just really embodied and expressed what Connie and I call deep time eyes and the magic that brings a sense of the sacred, the holy, in a whole different, this world, realistic way.
The question of how this has inspired me and moved me into and changed my earlier ways of thinking, that same view goes on so much to see if I look at the future of things, to realize that I'm not just plunked here. I've grown out of the same story, the same history of these separate threads coming together to be me, as in A Symphony of Science where it says that parts of the universe come together to be you just for a minute. And that's what we have. I look to the future and I think, I get to be not just a part of this web, not just to have these roots stretching off across the continent in all these different directions, not just to have this powerful heritage. All that is incredible and wonderful. But in addition to that, I get to help craft the world of tomorrow for our kids and the kids of everyone else, for this whole future of this web, not just humans, but everything on Earth, to have a meaning and a purpose to build something so incredibly great, this ongoing story of the universe that implies and gives me such incredible meaning and purpose. I can't imagine living without that, and yet I see every time I turn around, people just living to punch the clock. And I think, oh, it's like coming to animal hospital and finding a animal that has its arms and legs tore off, and you think, oh, what a diminished existence. And that's so much less of a diminished existence than what I see between the potential of humans to have this full meaning and purpose behind them and ahead of them, to be integrated to this web of life and instead just be punching the clock. Or even worse, living in fear of being tortured forever by some cosmic terrorist or 100 other terrible things that people are living with today. I think, ah, oh, it's just missing the boat.
So, so John, if you could share just a little bit, many people who are religious are afraid that if they didn't have their fundamentalism, if they didn't have their literal understanding of God, as a punishing God, that sort of thing, you know, what reason, why would they be moral? And perhaps, you know, they're tormented by their own inherited proclivities, and it was Jesus that saved them, and so they can't imagine that if they weren't a born-again Christian, if they weren't committed to God, what would keep them from acting on their worst nature? So I'm curious to hear you share, what is it that allows you, that motivates you, that inspires you morally, ethically? Why live the good life? How do you get that from a naturalistic perspective?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind from a naturalistic perspective is how I got here. I look at my ancestry, going all the way back to single cells and before, and I think time and again, the universe has has managed to bring this into existence with whatever kind of chance and situation, this is what has happened again and again. And then I get into the animals and look at this struggle for existence that they lived through literally billions, trillions of times of lives of struggling to exist just to get to the next generation, just to have kids that survive, just to see these kids go on and exist on their own. And I move on to the human trials and struggles in the same way, or even just before human, where we've got emotions and social networking and intrigue and competition, all these things that have allowed us to be here, the efforts and the mental struggles, the physical struggles of countless ancestors, of dramas that would be so much more moving than any movie we have today, that all did it with the result of having me be here. That if they hadn't done that, I wouldn't be here. I look at all the effort they put forth to just accomplish this. And I think to myself, how could I not be unbelievably grateful for all that's been done to allow me to be here? I know that most of the time they weren't thinking, oh, this is so John Cleland Host can exist, right? I know they're not thinking that.
Hey,
but
most of those ancestors you and I share.
Yeah, that's right.
Connie Barlow.
That's right. Most of them we share. And so I think, you know, with all that, with that mountain of pain and effort and parental love that we're all standing on, I feel nothing but incredible gratitude to that. I want to pay it back. But of course I can't. They're all dead. Right? So how do I pay it back? The same way they did for their ancestors. I pay it forward. I pay it to my kids. I raise my kids. As parents, we know that we do all this work for our kids. We don't expect to get paid back by them. We've been paid back in advance by our parents. And I think that's why to live morally, because while it is true that the moral things we've learned, many of them, were selected for, they're not some ultimate truth. They're things that were selected for because they work. We have to look at those and see which ones are going to work in the future so that we can pay it back and use the morals that are the ones that work to live morally, to keep life, keep the pulse of life strong in my Native American ancestors would say to keep the sacred fire strong. Think for seven generations in the future, and I say for us at least that, to think in that way, to think, is this morality that I'm going to live, is it going to give us a just, peaceful, and sustainable world for our future generations? That's the key. Is this beneficial for the people? And that's why to live morally. And when someone I talk with so many other people with a naturalistic worldview, most of them are discouraged atheists who have jettisoned any meaning from their life just because they found that the one that's given to them with the biblically based one is just completely absurd. So they jettison any kind of meaning like this and purpose, and they just say, I'm just going to have nothing, which is better than something that's even worse than nothing. And I think to myself, how can you choose not to live? How can you choose not to be alive? You're not alive. You have to be in this, working to be alive. And if you don't feel that connection, then you're not alive. And I think to myself, if I was going to choose not to be not alive, I'd choose not to be not alive and go shoot myself. And why would anyone want to do that? If I could not imagine turning around to this mountain of struggle and pain and effort and love and say, oh, yeah, thanks, I'm just going to shoot myself. Right? What would they think? Oh, I did all that so that you could shoot yourself? But if you're living without a meaning and a purpose, that's what you're doing. You might as well shoot yourself. What's the point?
So John, any last things that you'd love to share? What's fresh for you? What's current? What's on your excitement edge, your growing edge, or just anything at all that you're led to share here as we close this incredible conversation?
Before the rest of your family.
Before the rest of your family descends.
Before the chaos.
Before the tornadoes come. Yeah. Right. I don't know. All I can say is it's not quite a balance, but a mix between all this wonderful good stuff and all this wonderful, terribly harmful stuff. And just to look at it all and grab it and say, I'm just going to keep doing what I can do to keep things moving. I look at, you know, learning our deep time past, we learn about terrible things. We learn that some of our ancestors are rapists and murderers and people who tortured other people and just the worst of everything. And we learn about some of the terrible disasters that have happened and some of the things that evil things that people have done intentionally. I'm, as someone with European descent, just like so many others, people of us with European descent, I'm sure we've got people who've done terrible stuff. For instance, during the religious wars from the 1500s to the 1700s, when all the different denominations of Christians killed each other because they were the wrong denomination of Christian. And so many other things like that. And I think to myself, oh, it's just so terrible. And at the same time, we've got so much wonder. I look at the world and I see all these problems and these struggles, economics and other ones, and so many people now in this recession are just struggling to get by. There's people who are abusive to their kids, to their families. I see all this terrible stuff. And I also see all the wonderful stuff, all the wonderful stuff that so many people are doing. I watch the Symphony of Science videos. I see all this stuff and I think it's all really there. We can be in there and we can push things as good as we can in a good direction. It's going to be a constant struggle. It's never going to stop, no matter how good a job people do from an evolutionary standpoint. There's always going to be challenges, and that's fine, and that's good. A just, sustainable, peaceful world is not a final goal. It's something we're working towards, so we're more in that direction. But we can rest assured that all of our future generations are going to have a nice, ready supply of challenges to address.
Yeah. John, you've mentioned three times now the Symphony of Science music videos. You don't know this, but we've chosen the video number 5, Symphony of Science, Poetry of Reality, as our theme song.
Oh, so, that's what we start.
Yeah. So as we sign off here, recognize that as we say our goodbyes, we will have our Poetry of Reality slipping in here. So signing off from Upper Hamlin Lake, the biogeographic region of my 5 generations back of paternal grandparents. This is Connie Barlow.
And Michael Dowd.
And John Cleland Host.
There's real poetry in the real world. Science is the poetry of reality.
We can do science, and with it, we can improve our lives.
There's real poetry in the real world. Science is the poetry of reality.
The story of humans is a story of ideas that shine light into dark corners.